Okay, I think we can get started now. Welcome everyone, my name is Erin Cameron and I will be the acting facilitator for today's webinar, Poor Minority Neighborhoods Attract More Pollution. On behalf of SAFE, I'd like to thank you for attending today's webinar. Your interest and support make our work possible. Today's webinar is a great opportunity to share, learn, participate, ask questions, and get involved. We're very excited to share the latest information on clean energy policy, technology, and science with you through our monthly webinar series. I want to take a moment and direct you to the control panel on your screen. All of our lines have been muted, so you will need to write in your questions under the questions option on your control panel. Your questions will be fielded in the order they are received and will be answered at the end of our webinar. All material from this presentation will also be available on our website, cleanenergy.org. For those of you not familiar with SAFE, we are a regional organization with 5 offices across the Southeast. For over 25 years, we've been a leading advocate for clean, responsible energy choices on the federal, state, and local levels. We are a membership organization, and we'd like to thank all of our members on this call and encourage those of you who are not members to please become a member today. You can do this by visiting our website as well, cleanenergy.org, which is listed at the bottom of this slide. I'd like to now turn the presentation over to Chandra Rawls, SAFE Diversity and Community Partnerships Coordinator.
Thanks, Erin. So I'm just going to give a brief overview quickly before we hop into the webinar for today. So I just wanted to start out and just talk about the fact that we have seen examples time and time again that show low-income and communities of color suffer disproportionate impacts from dirty energy choices here in the Southeast. These impacts are often seen in the form of public health impacts, to economic disparities, to climate vulnerabilities. And so Green Law recently released a report to confirm some of these trends, specifically, however, for people who live in Metro Atlanta. So today we are pleased to have David Deganian from Green Law and Nick DeLuzio from Newfields to present the report. I'll hand over the presentation now to Nick and David. Thanks.
Hi there. Good afternoon. This is David Deganian. I'm an attorney with Green Law. My work is focused on environmental justice work, and I was one of 2 principal authors of our Patterns of Pollution report.
I'm Nick DeLuzio, staff scientist and GIS analyst with Newfields in Atlanta.
And I'm going to talk initially a little bit about the genesis of the report, and then Nick is going to go into some of the science that was used for our GIS, Global Information Systems Mapping, and then I'm going to talk about the results of the study. As the title here in the slide says, the Patterns of Pollution report is about demographics and pollution in Metro Atlanta. And, of course, when you talk about demographics and pollution, it brings up the subject of environmental justice. And as I said, that's the work that I do, so I wanted to just initially start with a description of what environmental justice is. EPA's definition covers the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, origin, or income. And environmental justice can be interpreted in different ways, but you know, some things that may come up involving fair treatment and meaningful involvement are ensuring that all people participate in public participation processes when polluting facilities are located in their areas, that facilities aren't intentionally siting factories or landfills in areas that are already low-income or minority communities. For us at Green Law, what we focus on when we think about meaningful involvement and fair treatment is about providing legal representation to groups around environmental policy. So, for example, just the other day I submitted comments on a proposed biomass facility in DeKalb County, and we did that on behalf of a small community group, and the facility is a biomass facility that's going to burn wood and emit toxic chemicals. into an area that's about 90% African American. It's within a few miles of three separate landfills and quite a few other air pollution facilities. So we see it as our job to represent them when, in many times, that they themselves wouldn't be able to afford an attorney or don't have the resources for some reason or another. And that might not be the case if the facility is going to be sited in an area that was higher income. Some of the key environmental justice issues that arise are, of course, the disproportionate burden in terms of pollution impacts. Who's living nearest to pollution, who's being impacted the most by air, water, and land pollution is kind of course, the obvious thing that comes up, and that's what we're going to be talking about mostly today. Unfair treatment. Who are facilities that are located in low-income and minority communities? Are they being observed and cited and covered in the same ways that maybe facilities in other areas are? Lack of involvement in decision-making. So an example, you know, when this may arise is if you're siting or if you're locating a facility in an area that's predominantly Latino or Asian, are they able to participate in those processes because they may not speak English? In a low-income area, maybe the education level, they're not able to follow some of the nuances of permitting. They're not able to have an attorney represent them in some of the permit decision-making that happens. And then finally, is the community that's burdened the same community that benefits? A lot of times when a facility is going to be located in a low-income or minority neighborhood, there's a lot of talk about the jobs that are going to go toward that facility. So they may say, yes, it's going to emit a certain amount of pollution, but it's going to boost your economy and you're going to get a lot of jobs in there. Well, that doesn't always turn out to be the case. Sometimes the jobs are brought in from other areas. And often sometimes the products that are being produced aren't being used by the community in which the facility is located. Just as a preface to our study, I wanted to talk a bit about some of the studies that have been done in the past that look at where polluting facilities are and what the demographics are of the people who live nearby. And there were quite a few of these studies done back in the 80s and in the 90s. In 1987, the Toxic Waste and Rape Study is probably the most famous. There they looked at hazardous waste facilities, I believe just in the southeast, and they looked at the some demographic variables of the people who live near those facilities, and they found race to be the most influential variable. So more than income, more than education, they found race to have the most direct correlation to hazardous waste facilities. And quite a few other studies that I've read follow along, or at least found race to be one of the more directly correlated factors. I wanted to highlight a 1995 City of Atlanta study that was done where they looked at the release of toxics in Atlanta neighborhoods, and they found there that income and to a lesser extent race had a strong correlation to where these toxic releases were occurring. As far as I know, this is one of the only studies that was done really focusing here on the City of Atlanta, which is where Greenlaw is and where Newfields is and where I focus a lot of my work. And then in 2007, the Toxic Waste and Race study was done again 20 years later, and rather than finding that the problem had lessened, they found that it had actually gotten worse and that the racial disparities in where these hazardous waste facilities were located were actually greater. Now, the study that we released this year, we had some very specific goals in mind, and some of those were to help me in my work when I represent communities and just investigating where some of these facilities are. First, I wanted to know where are the sources of pollution, what we call pollution points. Where are air pollution sources? Where are landfills? Where are water discharges happening? And wanted to have the most recent data that we could find. We also wanted to look at demographic characteristics, and we used mostly 2010 census data to find out what is the racial background. What languages are people speaking, all those kinds of things. We gathered that data. Using that data, we wanted to understand the correlation between pollution and demographics. Is there a relationship in this area between the race of a community and the number of pollution points that are within close proximity? And then finally, we wanted to identify environmental justice hotspots in Metro Atlanta. Those are areas that have the strongest correlation between race and pollution. the first step was identifying the study area. And for those of you that aren't calling in from Georgia, the Metro Atlanta region is a huge area. It's defined in many different ways between 32 counties and 8 counties or 10 counties. What I did was I looked at the metropolitan statistical area that the census defines as, I think, 32 counties, and that includes one county in Alabama, Chambers County, and narrowed by only including counties that had a population density of 300 people or more. And that was with a goal of looking at really just urban and suburban areas. And so we came up with these 14 counties. They just happened to be contiguous, which was great for us. So that's what you're looking at there. And then from here, I'm going to hand it off to Nick to describe how we came up with the results.
Great. Thanks, David. So I'm going to go briefly over the data and kind of the analysis portion of our study. In terms of data, we compiled pollution and demographic data from multiple sources. For the pollution, we used 8 different data sets and 8 different sources of pollution. So as you can see on the list, we have permitted air facilities, NPDES facilities, which is basically water releases, hazardous waste inventory sites, toxic release inventory sites, CERCLA or Superfund sites, RCRA, which is hazardous waste storage sites, and we have active solid waste landfills, and finally, permit violations and enforcement actions taken by either EPA or Georgia EPD for the violation of environmental laws. On the demographic side, we collected data on 7 different demographic characteristics: the percent population that's non-white, percent of vacant housing units, median housing value, median family income, percent of population living in poverty, percent of households that are linguistically isolated, that being that they either don't speak English, they don't speak English proficiently, or they speak another language as their primary language. And finally, the percent of population with a high school degree. We took all these different data types and data variables and combine them into, I developed a model within GIS. For those of you that may not be familiar with GIS, you can think of it as a Google Maps or Google Earth. It's kind of a very basic form, and this is the same kind of concept, just much more powerful with many more features. It allows you to map data spatially, so you can examine those patterns. And what you'll see on the screen now is the same pollution, the same data variables that I just went over. But what I want you to take away from this is we had 2 different sets of data in many different units. So you'll see on the left the pollution source data, those were points across the Metro Atlanta area. Our demographic data was on the census tract level. And then if you look down the list of individual variables, some of them are percentages, some are and some are monetary values. And so I had to develop a model that takes all of these different variables and data types and combines them into a format that is easily usable and that gives us the results that we want. So to do this, we developed a study grid, and we basically created a grid of 10 square kilometer cells and overlaid that over the entire study area. And this gives us a common spatial scale that we can use to join the data to and get it in a common format. And we initially looked at using census blocks, but we decided that census blocks cover too much of a geographic area, and they're also highly variable in size. And we decided that using a 10 square kilometer grid gives us a finer resolution and a uniform resolution over the entire area that we're looking for. Now, first step of the model is divided into kind of 3 parts. The first part handles the pollution score data. And you'll see in the screen on the left, these are all of the air, permitted facilities within our study area. And you'll see each point represents a specific facility. And what I did is I took these points and joined them to the grid. And that being for each grid cell, the GIS software sums up the number of points in that cell and assigns whatever value that is to the cell. So if you look at the map on the right, you'll see the cells that are red, these have between 11 and 25 points. The cells that are green have 0 points. And what I hope you'll notice is that the patterns in the map on the left match the patterns in the map on the right. So we see a lot of dots on the map on the left, mainly around the city and south. You see a lot of red and orange on the map on the right. We repeated this for all 8 of the pollution data sets, and then summed all those up to yield what we call a pollution score. Now, the pollution score is basically a count of every type of pollution point that falls within a single grid cell. So, again, the points that you see that are red have anywhere from 9 to 55 pollution points within that given 10 square kilometer areas. Once we did this, we broke out, we separated out into 5 categories, which you can see in the legend. And these 5 categories represent quantiles, meaning the GIS software breaks these points out into 5 groups that are as even as possible in numbers. Now, in this case, it may not look even because we had so many blocks with a zero value. So all the zero value blocks are clumped together. The remaining blocks are divided up into 4 groups that are as even as possible in number. And this quantile theme is important that will carry on kind of throughout the rest of the model. The second portion of the model deals with the demographic data. And this was a little trickier because it's a completely different format from the pollution data. As you can see on the left, this is the percent non-white population represented by census tract. And again, the colors represent the 5 quantiles that I talked about earlier. So the first step in this is to take the map that you see on the right and convert the data or reclassify it using a GIS lingo into 5 quantiles again. In this case, the 1 value represents communities that have a predominantly white population, and a 5 represents communities that are predominantly minority population. And again, I hope that what I want you to notice is that the map on the left and the map on the right should look very similar. All we're doing is just taking the data, and instead of it being on a 0 to 100 scale, we're giving it a score of 1 to 5 based on the quantile theme. As with pollution, we repeated this for all the 7 demographic layers. We scored each one from 1 to 5, and then we added those up, and that gives us a demographic score. So the 5th quantile, what you see is pink, those are areas that are primarily minority population, low income, they do not speak English, a lot of them may not have high school diplomas. So that's kind of what you're looking at in 5. 1 are going to be primarily white, higher income, they speak English, and most of them have a high school diploma. The final portion of the model is to take the pollution score, the total pollution score, as you see on the left, and the demographic score, which you see on the right, and combine them. And to do this, we use the GIS software to select the 10 square kilometer blocks that rank in the top quantile, so have a score of 5 for both pollution and for demographics. So this shows us, this will give us the blocks that have the most pollution points within them, as well as the demographic characteristics associated with environmental justice, being minority population, low income, and so forth. And when we do that, it yields our final output. And so we're calling these environmental justice hotspots. And the model yields, for the entire area, yielded 52 blocks that rank in the top quantile for both pollution and for demographic score. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to David to discuss the results.
So this is the same slide again. Nick's gone over what we've done so far, which is to identify the sources of pollution, identify the demographic characteristics, and I'm now going to talk a little bit about the correlation between pollution and demographics and a little bit of a more in-depth look at environmental justice hotspots. So in looking at the demographic characteristics and pollution, we found that some of the characteristics had a direct correlation to pollution, to the location of pollution points, and some did not. So I'm going to talk about first which ones did have a direct correlation. The strongest direct correlation between pollution points and demographics was race. We found that the quantile or squares that had a non-white population of less than 25% had on average only about one pollution point in close proximity. When you look at the quantiles that had more than 50% non-white population, we found that they had on average a little bit more than four pollution points. So you see that they have about four times as many pollution points within close proximity. The next strongest correlation was linguistic isolation rate. So these are households that don't speak English fluently. Again, you see a similar pattern. Quantiles that had less than 5% of people who were able to speak English well had about one pollution point on average, and you really see a big rise when you look at areas that have more than 20% population. So there's definitely a connection between people who are not able to speak English and the number of pollution points in close proximity, which I think both that and the race issue raise a lot of questions and probably deserve a closer look in the future. Next, poverty rate, again, a strong direct correlation. You can see here there's a rise when you get to poverty rates that are above about 10%. We're looking at three pollution points, and again, once you get over 20%, we're looking at about five pollution points. Vacant housing rate is, again, a similar pattern. This was the fourth and last characteristic that we found had a direct correlation. You really see a high number of pollution points when you get above a 15% vacant housing rate. When you look at housing value, we really didn't see a strong correlation between pollution and the housing values. Really, the numbers stayed the same, whether you're looking at homes that are valued at over $100,000 or over $250,000. And here you see some of the demographic characteristics that had an indirect correlation. What that means is that as high school graduation rates rose, the number of pollution points declined. And then you see a really interesting pattern between family income and pollution points. There's a huge number, or at least an extraordinary number for our study of pollution points associated with family incomes below $25,000. So any of those squares that had an average or median income below $25,000 had on average 15 pollution points, and that declined significantly when you looked at incomes above $25,000. So beyond looking at just the correlations there, I think it's also interesting to look at which blocks are the high pollution blocks and which ones are the low pollution blocks and kind of comparing what the people who live in those blocks look like or what their incomes are, et cetera. On the left, you're seeing the high pollution blocks. These are the blocks that are in the top tier or top quantile, as we called it. If you're familiar with the Metro Atlanta area, there are some areas that are not surprising, like Central Fulton, downtown Atlanta area, where there's a lot of industry. But there are some areas that were somewhat surprising. Hall County had a good cluster of these high pollution blocks. There's some big poultry manufacturing there, and some other rural areas where you're seeing either a high number of violations that are reported or more industry than one would suspect. And on the right, you see pollution, the low pollution blocks. Those are blocks that had no identified pollution points, and those are mostly kind of in the rural or suburban areas on the outskirts of the county. And looking at the pollution blocks, like I said, it's interesting to look at the people who are living in those areas. What we found was that the low pollution blocks, the one with no pollution points, had on average only about a 25% non-white population. So about three-quarters of the people living there where I have been identified as white. Compare that to high pollution blocks, and you find that about 44.2% of those people are non-white. So you see almost twice as many people living in the high pollution blocks are minorities. It's a pretty striking difference there. And then finally, looking at environmental justice hotspots, we were able to identify all 52 of these hotspots where the correlation between pollution and demographics was strongest, and we were actually able to rank them according to their pollution scores and demographic scores. So you can see the numbers are 1 through 52, and again, a lot of them are centralized around Fulton County, downtown area. You also see some blue squares. Those are what we called environmental justice cold spots. Those are areas where the pollution scores were highest, but the demographic scores were lowest. So you may have higher income, higher populations of whites. Most people are able to speak English, but there are some areas where those people are living with high numbers of pollution points. What's interesting is, you know, both to highlight the fact that that exists, but also to show that there are such a small number of cold spots compared to the hot spots. So you see it happens much more infrequently across Metro Atlanta for the low demographic profile to sort of coexist with a high pollution score. And this is just an interesting graphic that shows the number of environmental justice hotspots in the counties. Fulton has the highest, followed by Clayton, then Cobb, and DeKalb and Hall. And I'm just going to quickly run through the top five environmental justice hotspots that we identified. And, you know, bear with me for those of you who don't live in the Metro Atlanta area. I know that you're probably not familiar with these areas, but if you do live here, then you're probably familiar with a few of them. The first is this area that's at the intersection of Cobb, Douglas, and Fulton counties. This is the Fulton industrial area. So most people who live here know this as a big manufacturing and transportation hub. This square had the most pollution points, the highest number of pollution points of any other square in Metro Atlanta at 55. And the majority of those were air pollution sites or violations that were reported. So you can see the yellow dots represent violations and the black dots represent a good chain of air pollution sites that exist along that road. And then the demographic, some of the interesting demographic findings in that area are that there are very high non-white population, 86.6%, comparatively very low median family incomes and high vacant housing rates. So it's just interesting to look at these areas and see where you find the coexistence of very high pollution points and this high demographic profile. And I'm going to just briefly run through all five, but I think that they all, again, deserve a closer look in the future. The second is in Cherokee County. The reason why this is a rural area or suburban area, the reason why it showed up as the number two environmental justice hotspot is because of low high school graduation rates, very low median incomes, and a few other demographic highlights matched with a very high number of Clean Water Act violations occurring around the Canton area in Cherokee County. The third hotspot is just at the connection between Gwinnett and DeKalb counties. You may be familiar with this area as the Buford Highway area. It has high minority rates as well, but these are mostly Latino and Asian populations. And I think this is an interesting graphic here, this shows that square in a kind of zoomed in area, and you can see some of the five toxic releases that occurred in the last couple of years. The most recent reporting year we could get for the toxic releases was 2010, I believe, and this shows just a few of them that occurred, or all five of them that occurred in that block. Some of the other pollution points that were are in higher numbers are air pollution sites and violations. And again, you have high minority rates, but what's really interesting here is the linguistic isolation rate. So you've got 45% of people who are unlikely to be able to speak English. So you really have to think about, are they able to participate in public processes? Are they aware of siting? Are they aware of these violations that are occurring? Do they have the ability to understand what their legal rights may be and what some of the dangers may be from these sites, if there are any? The fourth one is in central Fulton County. Again, a good bit of air pollution sites and industry. And all of these pollution points, the top five are described in detail in our report, which we'll provide a link to at the end of the webinar. So I'm not going to go into much detail about the other two. The last is in central Douglas County. And again, you know, high minority rates, a good number of industries that are polluting into the air and water. So just briefly, I wanted to talk about what the state-level response is to environmental justice. So our report shows that you have these patterns that, at least to me, are somewhat alarming and highlight where these environmental justice hotspots are. And for all we know, this trend is going to continue onward to where low-income minority communities are being disproportionately affected by the pollution around them. So interestingly, Georgia is one of only five states, at least according to our study, that does not have an environmental justice policy, law, or employee. The green on the right, there are 18 states that have an environmental justice policy or law, and many of those states also have an employee. So those are the ones that have sort of the most in place in regard to environmental justice. 27 states have an employee who is at least dedicated to doing environmental justice work, someone who can be called when there's an environmental justice issue, someone who can make a complaint, someone who could develop a policy for consideration of demographics and permitting. Only five states, including Georgia, don't have either. So there really isn't, unfortunately, anyone in Georgia who is focusing on this work, at least at the state regulatory level. And just to show that, you know, we're not all just backwards here in the South, there are some other states, in fact, all the states that are that border Georgia do have some kind of environmental justice initiative, policy, employee in place, and this slide highlights what those initiatives are. And just briefly, we provide in the study our recommendations on steps that can be taken to, at first, really just deal with the issue of environmental justice now that we have the information in front of us, and then, you know, to make change. The first is looking at advocates like myself who do environmental justice work, people who are working at nonprofits, attorneys, residents, neighborhood groups, all the people that, you know, at the grassroots level, getting together and really focusing on this issue. I go to so many different meetings about different things from farming to air pollution to water pollution, and although there has been in the past, there is no group right now that's focused on environmental justice and really strategizing on solutions. So I think that is in many ways the most important first step. The next is looking at a working group, which would be a group that would include industry and government to formulate solutions. Of course, if you want to make any steps forward, you have to involve the people who have power and who have money and who make decisions that can benefit all of us. And I think that bringing them into the conversation is very important to getting a policy in place and to dealing with some of the issues we've shown here. Third is looking at EPA. We've provided at least some information on ways in which EPA could address environmental justice at the state level. A lot of the environmental justice policies are at the federal level, but in fact, EPD, our state agency, does about 90% of permitting. So what are ways in which funding could be tied to environmental justice? What are ways in which guidance could be provided directly to the state agency? What's a very important step is moving EPD toward considering environmental justice, putting resources toward the issue, and really being willing to talk to residents about it, to go beyond the normal steps when you're doing siting and permitting up facilities in areas that are minority areas. So those are our recommendations. Again, look at the report. There's more there. And then this last slide here shows a link to GreenLaw's website where we have both the report and a map, greenlaw.org/patterns of pollution. And Nick is going to click on that link, and we're going to show you what I think is a pretty cool website that Newfield's created for us, where you can actually type in your address here in Metro Atlanta and get an environmental justice fact sheet. So you can look at what are the pollution points near where I live and what is the demographic profile, and also compare that to other areas in Metro Atlanta. And if you don't live in Metro Atlanta, unfortunately, it doesn't go beyond the 14-county area. But if you don't have a specific address in mind, you can kind of toggle around and go over these points. Nick, can you show them? If you toggle over the points, it'll highlight what their names are and things like that. So addresses, and you can get more information. So we thought it would be just to type in an address that everyone's familiar with. It's Turner Field, home of the Braves, who are playing right now, playing the Giants, I believe. So Nick's going to type that in, and we're going to look at what the environmental justice fact sheet is of that area. So the last thing, you could just toggle over the points, but here this will give you the PDF, and it will show you within your area there are 77 air pollution points, 4 water sites, 6 toxic release sites, 15 hazardous waste sites, 14 Superfund sites, no landfills, no RCRA sites, and 22 violations. Now, this is a heavy industry area, so we're not surprised to find that our ranking is in the very high pollution score relative to other areas. So, you know, this is basically right in downtown Atlanta. And then you can see the points, and scroll down, you also get a demographic profile. There, the population that's non-white is close to 100% at 93.8. Very high vacant housing rates, very low median housing values, high poverty rates. So we didn't actually choose this place as an environmental justice. We weren't trying to show a specific environmental justice area. We just wanted to pick a – we actually hadn't looked at the fact sheet until now, but it's interesting to see that there is a pretty strong connection between the demographic profile and the pollution points. So, and it also – you'll get a list of the pollution points with their distance from your area. So if you live in Metro Atlanta or just want to check it out, I think it's a great resource, and please read the report, and we'll be happy to try to answer any questions that you have for us.
And briefly, just before we open up to questions, I want to circle back to one point I neglected to mention. But since this is kind of a regional audience, although our report and the model and our analysis focus on the Atlanta area, this is the same principle can be applied to almost any city, state, region throughout the country. All the data that we use is publicly available. And so the same process and same procedure can be used in Birmingham or Asheville or the entire state of Alabama if one chooses. So it is, we focus on Atlanta, but kind of our process as a whole is easily adaptable to any other area. And with
okay,
that, I guess
thanks,
we'll.
Thanks, guys. Are you ready for some questions?
Yep.
Sure.
Okay. We have a few questions here. One, how do other cities in our region access resources to develop similar reports for their communities?
So if go ahead, Nick.
This is Nick. The data that we acquired and used in this project, the pollution point data, is almost all of it's available, most of it's available through the EPA. And there's a few data sets that are available through the Georgia EPD, the Environmental Protection Division. And so the data that we use for any city or any state should be available through both EPA and then that state's environmental agency. The demographic data that we acquired was all available through the U.S. Census Bureau. So most of it was either from the 2010 census itself or from the 2009 American Community Survey, which is a subset of the U.S. Census Bureau.
And I'll just say, Nick gathered all the demographic data, and we at GreenLaw got the pollution data. And the pollution data you should be able to find through your, whether it's online through your state agency or by doing a request, and you can really probably make a phone call to get that information. Where you may stumble and find it a little bit more difficult is looking at the violation data. A lot of that is available via EPA's ECHO website, E-C-H-O, but some of that you're going to have to find by digging through files, or at least we did at your state environmental agency.
Okay, great. Another question, has this information been presented to EPA, and what have they proposed to do with the findings?
So we're actually doing a webinar for EPA late in the year, and I've gone down and spoken to the people that I know at EPA that make some of the regulatory decisions. It's been sent to the regional administrator. I've been told that they've looked at it and they found it interesting. No one has contacted me directly to really talk in more detail about what we found. I think that, you know, when you're working with a government agency, they have their own methods and ways that they want to do things. And so I'm hopeful that it'll be something that they'll want to look at and talk further about, because I don't think that they've done anything yet that is at this level of detail. And I think it, you know, is in some ways a striking report that they should be able to use. And I've also presented it to a few people at EPD, and again, the reaction has been very positive. They're interested in the information, but I haven't been able to get at the higher levels there. I've mailed it to them, but I haven't gotten feedback yet.
Thanks. Another question we have here, what is the best way to advocate for environmental justice policy in Georgia?
That's a tough question. That's the one that I've been trying to figure out myself over the last couple of years. I think there's a few different ways to go about it. I mean, I think that you can do it kind of discreetly. The way that GreenLaw does it in a lot of ways is to work just on specific projects. And so we may work with, you know, an environmental justice issue around a certain landfill. And you can get a lot of attention that way through legal action and through grassroots organizing. But if we're talking about, you know, larger scale environmental justice in Georgia, I think that first step that I talked about, which is getting together advocates and people who are interested in environmental justice and really strategizing on solutions, because unless we're able to really figure out a way to advocate for environmental justice public policy as a group, I don't think anything's going to change. For some reason or another, the state has been able to kind of get by without dealing with environmental justice in a regulatory level. And, you know, there is a heavy minority population here in Georgia, and I think it's sort of astounding that it's not something that's considered by the agency that permits 90% of, you know, environmental permits in Georgia. So it's about, you know, being organized as a unit, and I think that GreenLaw is trying to take the lead on that, but of course we need support from other nonprofits and, you know, hopefully the government as well.
Great, thank you. A couple more questions here. What are the other five states that do not have an environmental justice law or policy that you mentioned in one of your slides?
Oh, you know, I gathered that data a while back, and this was through Hastings Law School does an environmental justice survey that comes out, I think, every 2 to 3 years. And what we did was we looked in detail through all their data, which is, I think it's like a 150-page document, and created a spreadsheet for what each state has. If I don't know off the top of my head, unfortunately, what those five states are, the other four states are. Anybody can find my email address on the website, and I'd be happy to look again at the spreadsheet and find out what those other four states are. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you, Nick. And so one other question. Does GreenLaw or Newfield have the capacity or resources or plans to do a similar report regionally versus counties?
Well, we look at this as a regional study. So, I mean, it's 14 counties. It's the metro Atlanta area. As Nick said, a lot of the work has been done on developing a model to do this again. We don't have any plans right now to do one across Georgia. I think it would be interesting to do one across Georgia and see where the environmental justice hotspots fall and if the same patterns exist across the state. Our focus now is really using this report to make positive change. Greenlaw is going to be focused on that, and maybe we'll do some studies, further on. Unfortunately, they're extremely time consuming and expensive. So we're lucky to have what we got.
Well, thank you both so much for sharing this information with us. I think we're going to wrap it up. That's all the questions that we have. So thank you. And on behalf of SAFE, I'd like to thank all of you for being here with us today and for your thoughtful questions. We are really excited about our monthly webinar series, as it's a great way for us to connect with you, our members and supporters, on the critical issues we all care so much about. This presentation and recording of today's webinar will be posted on our website via our webinar archive page. And if nobody has anything else to say, I think we will close. Okay, thanks so much, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a great day.
Thank you.